I'll do that, Dante. I got this vision that one day my mama and my brothers and sister will stand beside my grave and celebrate because I'm an innocent man. Won't that be great, Robbie? I'll be there too, Dante. Throw a big party. Right there in the cemetery. Invite all my friends. Raise all sorts of hell. Let the world know that Dante is innocent. Will you do that, Robbie? You have my word. That'll be great. Robbie slowly took both of Dante's hands and squeezed them in his. I gotta go, big man. I don't know what to say, except that it's been an honor being your lawyer. I believed you from the very beginning, and I believe you even more today. I've always known you're innocent, and I hate the sons of bitches who are making this happen. I'll keep fighting, Dante, I promise. Their foreheads touched. Dante said, Thank you, Robbie, for everything. I'll be all right. I'll never forget you. Take care of my mama, okay, Robbie? You know I will. They stood and embraced, a long, painful hug that neither wanted to end. Ben Jeter was by the door waiting. Robbie finally left the holding cell and walked to the end of the short hallway where Keith sat in a folding chair, praying fervently. Robbie sat down beside him and began weeping. Ben Jeter asked Dante for the last time if he wanted to see the chaplain. He did not. The hallway began to fill with uniformed guards, large, healthy boys with stern faces and thick arms. The beef had arrived, just in case the inmate had second thoughts about going peacefully to the death chamber. There was a flurry of activity, and the place was filled with people. Jeter approached Robbie and said, Let's go. Robbie slowly got to his feet and took a step before he stopped and looked down at Keith. Come on, Keith, he said. Keith looked up blankly, not sure where he was, certain that his little nightmare would end soon and he'd wake up in bed with Dana. What? Robbie grabbed an arm and yanked hard. Come on. It's time to witness the execution. But the warden gave us approval. Another hard pull. You're the spiritual advisor to the condemned man, thus you qualify as a witness. I don't think so, Robbie. No, look, I'll just wait. Several of the guards were amused by the altercation. Keith was aware of their smirks, but didn't care. Come on, Robbie said, now dragging the minister. Do it for Dante. Hell, do it for me. You live in Kansas, a death penalty state. Come watch a little democracy in action. Keith was moving and everything was a blur. They walked by the columns of guards, past the holding cell where Dante, eyes down, was being handcuffed again, to a narrow unmarked door Keith had not noticed before. It opened and closed behind them. They were in a small box-like room with dim lights. Robbie finally turned loose of him, then walked over and hugged the Drum family. No more appeals, he said softly. There's nothing left to do. It would be the longest 10 minutes in Gil Newton's lengthy career in public service. From 5:50 until 6 p.m., he vacillated as never before. On one side, literally on one side of his office, Wayne pushed harder and harder for a 30-day reprieve. He argued that the execution could be delayed for 30 days and 30 days only, while the dust settled and the claims of this boyette clown could be investigated. If he was telling the truth and the body could be found, then the governor would be a hero. If he turned out to be a flake, as they strongly suspected, then Drum would live another 30 days and then get the needle. There was no long-term harm politically. The only permanent damage would occur if they ignored Boyette, executed Drum, then found the body exactly where Boyette took them. That would be fatal, and not just for Drum. The mood was so tense that they were ignoring the bourbon. On the other side, Barry argued that any form of retreat would be nothing but a show of weakness, especially in light of the governor's performance before the mob less than 3 hours earlier. Executions, especially high-profile ones, attract all sorts of attention seekers, and this guy Boyette was a perfect example. He was obviously looking for the spotlight, his 15 minutes on stage, and to allow him to derail a proper execution was wrong from a judicial point of view, and even more so from a political one. Drum confessed to the murder, Barry said, over and over. Don't let some serial pervert cloud the truth. It was a fair trial. The appeals courts, all of them, had affirmed the conviction. Play it safe, Wayne countered. Just 30 days. Maybe we'll learn something new about the case. But it's been 9 years, Barry retorted. Enough is enough. Are there any reporters outside? Newton asked. Sure, Barry said. They have been hanging around all day. Line them up. The final walk was a short one, some 30 feet from the holding cell to the death chamber, the entire pathway lined with guards, some of whom watched from the corners of their eyes to see the dead man's face. Others stared at the floor as if they were sentries guarding a lonely gate. One of three faces could be expected from the condemned man. The most common was a hard frown with wide eyes, a look of fear and disbelief. The second most common was a passive surrender, eyes half open as if the chemicals were already at work. The third and least common was the angry look of a man who'd kill every guard in sight if he had a gun. Dante Drum did not resist. That rarely happens. With a guard holding each elbow, he marched on, his face calm, his eyes on the floor. He refused to allow his captors to see the fear he felt, nor did he wish to acknowledge them in any way. For such a notorious room, the Texas Death Chamber is remarkably small, a near square box 12 feet long and wide, with a low ceiling and a permanent metal bed in the center, adorned in clean white sheets for each occasion. The bed fills the room. Dante could not believe how cramped it was. He sat on the edge of the bed and four guards quickly took over. They swung his legs around, stretched them out, then methodically secured his body with five thick leather straps, one around his chest, midsection, groin, thighs, and calves. His arms were placed on extensions 45 degrees from his body and secured with more leather straps. As they prepped him, he closed his eyes, listened to and felt the urgent business about him. There were grunts and a few words, but these men knew their tasks. This was the last stop on the system's assembly line, and the workers were well experienced. When all the straps were tightened, the guards retreated. A medical technician who smelled of antiseptic hovered and said, "I'm going to poke and find a vein. Left arm first, then the right. You understand?" "Be my guest," Dante said and opened his eyes. The technician was rubbing his arm with alcohol. "To prevent infection?" How thoughtful. Behind him was a darkened window, and below it was an opening from which two ominous tubes ran toward the bed. The warden was to his right, watching it all carefully, very much in charge. Behind the warden were two identical windows, the witness rooms, sealed off by curtains. If he'd been so inclined, and were it not for all the damned leather straps, Dante could have reached out and touched the nearest window. The tubes were in place, one in each arm, though only one would be used. The second one was a backup, just in case. At 5:59, Governor Gil Newton hurriedly stepped in front of three cameras outside of his office and, without notes, said, "My denial of a reprieve still stands. Dante Drum confessed to this atrocious crime and must pay the ultimate price. He received a fair trial 8 years ago by a jury of his peers, and his case has been reviewed by five different courts, dozens of judges, and all have confirmed his conviction. His claim of innocence is not believable, nor is this last-minute sensational effort by his attorneys to produce a new killer. The judicial system of Texas cannot be hijacked by some criminal looking for attention and a desperate lawyer who will say anything. God bless Texas." He refused to answer questions and returned to his office. When the curtains were suddenly opened, Roberta Drum nearly collapsed at the sight of her youngest son strapped tightly to the bed with tubes running from both arms. She gasped, covered her mouth with both hands, and had Cedric and Marvin not braced her, she would have been on the floor. The shock hit all of them. They squeezed tighter together, and Robbie joined the huddle, adding support. Keith was too stricken to move. He stood a few feet away. Some strangers were behind him, witnesses who had entered at some point, Keith wasn't sure when. They inched forward, straining for a view. It was Thursday, the second one in November, and at that moment the ladies' Bible class was meeting in the vestry of St. Mark's Lutheran for the continuation of their study of the Gospel of Luke, to be followed by a pasta dinner in the kitchen. Keith, Dana, and the boys were always invited to the dinner and usually attended. He really missed his church and his family, and he wasn't sure why he was having such thoughts as he stared at the very dark head of Dante Drum. It contrasted sharply with the white shirt he was wearing and the snow-white sheets around him. The leather straps were light brown. Roberta sobbed loudly, and Robbie was mumbling, and the unknown witnesses behind him were pressing for a better view, and Keith wanted to scream. He was tired of praying, and his prayers weren't working anyway. Keith asked himself if he would feel differently if Dante was guilty. He didn't think so. Guilt would certainly take away some of the sympathy for the kid, but as he watched the preliminaries unfold, he was struck by the coldness, the ruthless efficiency, the sanitized neatness of it. It was similar to killing an old dog, a lame horse, or a laboratory rat. Who exactly gives us the right to kill? If killing is wrong, then why are we allowed to kill? As Keith stared at Dante, he knew the image would never go away, and he knew that he would never be the same. Robbie stared at Dante, too, at the right side of his face, and thought of all the things he would have changed. In every trial, the lawyer makes a dozen snap decisions, and Robbie had relived them all. He would have hired a different expert, called different witnesses, toned down his attitude toward the judge, been nicer to the jury. He would always blame himself, though no one else did. He had failed to save an innocent man, and that burden was too heavy. A big piece of his life was about to perish also, and he doubted he would ever be the same. Next door, Reva wept at the sight of her daughter's killer flat on his back, helpless, hopeless, waiting to take his last breath and go on to hell. His death, quick and rather pleasant, was nothing compared to Nicole's, and Reva wanted more suffering and pain than she was about to witness. Wallace boosted her with an arm around her shoulder. She was held by her two children. Nicole's biological father was not there, and Reva would never let him forget it. Dante turned hard to his right, and his mother finally came into focus. He smiled, gave a thumbs up, then turned back and closed his eyes. At 6:01, Warden Jeter stepped to a table and picked up a phone, a direct line to the Attorney General's office in Austin. He was informed that all appeals were final. There was no reason to stop the execution. He replaced the receiver, then picked up another one, identical to the first. It was a direct line to the governor's office. The message was the same. Green lights all around. At 6:06, he stepped to the bed and said, "Mr. Drum, would you like to make a final statement?" Dante said, "Yes." The warden reached toward the ceiling, grabbed a small microphone, and pulled it to within 12 inches of Dante's face. "Go ahead," he said. Wires ran to a small speaker in each witness room. Dante cleared his throat, stared at the microphone, and said, "I love my mother and my father, and I'm so sad my dad died before I could say goodbye. The state of Texas would not allow me to attend his funeral. To Cedric, Marvin, and Andrea, I love y'all and I'll see you down the road. I'm sorry I put you through all this, but it wasn't my fault. To Robbie, I love you, man. You're the greatest. To the family of Nicole Yarber, I'm sorry about what happened to her. She was a sweet girl, and I hope someday they find the man who killed her. Then I guess you all will have to be here and do this again. He paused, closed his eyes, then yelled, I'm an innocent man. I've been persecuted for 9 years by the state of Texas for a crime I didn't do. I never touched Nicole Yarber, and I don't know who killed her. He took a breath, opened his eyes, and went on. To Detective Drew Kerber, Paul Cuffey, Judge Grail, all those bigots on the jury, all those blind mice on the appeals courts, and to Governor Newton, your day of judgment is coming. When they find the real killer, I'll be there to haunt you. He turned and looked at his mother. Goodbye, Mama. Love you. After a few seconds of silence, Ben Jeter pushed the microphone toward the ceiling. He took a step backward and nodded at the faceless chemist who hid behind the black window to the left of the bed. The injection began. 3 different doses given in quick succession. Each of the 3 was lethal enough if used alone. The first was sodium thiopental, a powerful sedative. Dante closed his eyes, never to reopen them. 2 minutes later, a dose of pancuronium bromide, a muscle relaxer, stopped his breathing. 3rd was a shot of potassium chloride that stopped his heart. With all the leather strapping, it was difficult to tell when Dante's breathing stopped, but stop it did. At 6:19, the medical technician appeared and prodded the corpse with a stethoscope. He nodded at the warden, who announced at 6:21 that Dante Drum was dead. Chapter 27. The curtains closed. The death chamber vanished. Reva hugged Wallace, and Wallace hugged Reva, and they hugged their children. The door to their witness room opened, and a prison official hurried them through it. 2 minutes after the announcement of death, Reva and her family were back in the van, whisked away with an amazing efficiency. After they left, the Drum family was escorted through a different door, but along the same route. Robbie and Keith were alone for a few seconds in the witness room. Robbie's eyes were wet, his face pale. He was thoroughly defeated, drained, but at the same time looking for someone to fight. Are you glad you watched it? He asked. No, I am not. Neither am I. At the train station, news of Dante's death was received without a word. They were too stunned to speak. In the conference room, they stared at the television, heard the words, but still couldn't believe that the miracle had somehow slipped away. Only 3 hours earlier, they had been frantically working on the Boyette petition and the Gamble petition, 2 11th-hour gifts from above that seemed so hopeful. But the TCCA rejected Boyette and literally slammed the door on Gamble. Now Dante was dead. Sammy Thomas cried softly in one corner. Carlos and Bonnie stared at the television as if the story might change to a happier ending. Travis Boyette sat hunched over, rubbing his head, while Fred Pryor watched him. They worried about Robbie. Boyette suddenly stood and said, I don't understand. What happened? Those people didn't listen to me. I'm telling the truth. You're too late, Boyette, Carlos snapped. 9 years too late, Sammy said. You sit on your ass for 9 years, perfectly willing to let someone else serve your time, and then you pop in here with 5 hours to go and expect everyone to listen to you? Carlos was walking toward Boyette, pointing a finger. All we needed was 24 hours, Boyette. If you'd shown up yesterday, we could have searched for the body. We find the body, there's no execution. There's no execution because they got the wrong guy. They got the wrong guy because they're stupid, but also because you're too much of a coward to come forward. Dante is dead, Boyette, because of you. Boyette's face turned crimson and he reached for his cane. Fred Pryor, though, was quicker. He grabbed Boyette's hand, looked at Carlos and said, Let's cool it. Everybody calm down. Sammy's cell phone buzzed. She glanced at it and said, "It's Robbie." Carlos turned away and Boyette sat down with Pryor close by. Sammy listened for a few minutes, then laid down the phone. She wiped a tear and said, "The press got it right for a change. He's dead. He said Dante was strong to the bitter end, proclaimed his innocence, did so very convincingly. Robbie's leaving the prison now. They'll fly back and be here around 8 o'clock. He would like for us to wait." She paused and wiped her face again. The National Guardsmen had just fanned out through the streets around Civitan Park in the white section and Washington Park in the black section when the news hit that Dante had been executed. The crowd in Civitan Park had grown steadily throughout the afternoon in both size and volume, and it immediately pressed outward toward the guardsmen. The soldiers were taunted, cursed, insulted. A few rocks were thrown, but the violence, seething just under the surface, was suppressed. It was near dark, and there was little doubt that nighttime would see the situation deteriorate. In Washington Park, the crowd was older and made up primarily of neighbors. The younger, rowdier ones headed across town where trouble was more likely. Homes were locked, vigils commenced on front porches, and weapons were at the ready. The sentries stepped up their patrols at every church in Sloan. 10 miles to the south, the mood was much merrier at the cabin. Huddled around the television, fresh drinks in hand, they grinned smugly when death was confirmed. Paul Coffey toasted Drew Kerber, then Drew Kerber toasted Paul Coffey. Glasses clinked together. The discomforting hesitation they had felt with that Boyette thing was quickly forgotten, at least for the moment. Justice had finally prevailed. Warden Jeter walked Robbie and Keith back to the front of the prison, shook their hands, said goodbye. Robbie thanked him for his thoughtfulness. Keith wasn't sure if he wanted to thank him or insult him. His last-second approval of Keith as a witness had led to a horrific experience. But he was gracious anyway, as was his nature. When they stepped through the front door, they saw where the noise was coming from. To the right, 3 blocks away and on the other side of a wall of police and state troopers, students were yelling and waving homemade banners and placards. They were packed together in the middle of a street that had been cordoned off. Beyond them, traffic was backed up. A wave of cars had tried to reach the prison, and when they were blocked, their drivers simply got out and joined the crowd. Operation Detour had planned to choke the prison with people and vehicles, and the plan was working. The goal of preventing the execution had not been reached, but Dante's supporters had at least been mobilized, and they had been heard. Aaron Ray was waiting on the sidewalk, waving Keith and Robbie over. "We found an escape route," he said. "This place is ready to blow up." They hurried to the minivan and took off. The driver began darting through side streets, dodging parked cars and angry students. Martha Handler studied Robbie's face, but he did not make eye contact. "Can we talk?" she asked. He shook his head no. Keith did the same. Both closed their eyes. A Huntsville funeral home had the contract. One of its black hearses was inside the walls unit, out of sight, and when the last of the witnesses and officials left the death house, it backed to the same gate where the vans had come and gone. A collapsible gurney was pulled out, extended, and rolled inside to the death chamber, where it was wedged tightly next to the bed where Dante lay motionless and unrestrained. The tubes had been removed and recoiled into the dark room where the chemist, still unseen, was filling out his paperwork. On the count of 3, 4 guards lifted the corpse gently and placed it on the gurney, where it was once again strapped, but not as tightly this time. A blanket, owned by the funeral home, was tucked over him, and when all was in place, the gurney was rolled back to the hearse. 20 minutes after the pronouncement of death, the body was leaving the walls unit, through a different route, to avoid the protesters and cameras. At the funeral home, the body was taken to a prep room. Mr. Hubert Lamb and his son Alvin, owners of Lamb and Son Funeral Home, Sloan, Texas, were waiting. They would embalm the body at their place in Sloan, on the same table where they had prepared Riley Drum 5 years earlier. But Riley had been an old man of 55 when he passed, his body shrunken and decayed, and his death had been anticipated. It could be explained. His sons could not. As men who dealt in death, constantly handling corpses, the Lambs figured they had seen it all. But they were taken aback by the sight of Dante lying peacefully on the gurney, his face content, his body undisturbed, a young man of 27. They had known him since he was a boy. They had cheered for him on the football field and, like all of Sloan, expected a long, glorious career. They had whispered and gossiped with the rest of the town when he was arrested. They were stunned by the confession and quick to believe Dante when he immediately recanted. The Sloan police, and Detective Kerber in particular, were not trusted on their side of town. The boy was tricked. They beat a confession out of him, just like in the old days. They watched with frustration as he was tried and convicted by a white jury, and after he was sent away, they, like the rest of the town, half expected the girl's body to show up, or maybe even the girl herself. With the help of two others, they lifted Dante from the gurney and gently placed him in a handsome oak casket selected by his mother on Monday. Roberta had paid a small deposit. She had burial insurance, and the Lambs were quick to agree to a full refund if the casket became unnecessary. They would have happily foregone the use of it. They had prayed they would not be where they were at that moment, collecting the body, then driving it home, then preparing for a painful wake, memorial, and funeral. The four men wrestled the casket into the Lamb and Son hearse, and at 7:02, Dante left Huntsville and headed home. The Fordyce Hitting Hard set was in a small ballroom in a cheap chain motel on the fringe of Huntsville. Reva and Wallace were perched on director's chairs and made up for the cameras, while Sean Fordyce stomped around in his usual manic mode. He just jetted in from an execution in Florida, barely made it to Huntsville, but so glad he did because the Nicole Yarber case had become one of his best ever. In preliminary chit-chat, as the technicians worked frantically on the sound, the lighting, the makeup, the script, Fordyce realized that Reva had not yet heard about the appearance of Travis Boyette. She had been inside the prison preparing for the big event when the story broke. Instinctively, he decided not to tell her. He would save it for later. The post-execution interview was the most dramatic segment of his show. Catch him just minutes after they've watched the bastard die and they might say anything. He snapped at a technician, cursed a cameraman, yelled that he was ready to go. A final dusting of powder on his forehead, then an instant change of demeanor as he looked at the camera, smiled, and became a man of great compassion. With tape running, he explained where he was, gave the time, the hour, the gravity of the moment. Then he walked to Reva and said, "Reva, it's over. Tell us what you saw." Reva, a Kleenex in each hand, she'd gone through a box since lunch, dabbed her eyes and said, "I saw him. For the first time in 8 years, I saw the man who killed my baby. I looked him in the eyes, but he would not look at me." Her voice was strong. No breakdown, yet. "What did he say?"
"He said he was sorry, and I appreciate that."
Fordyce leaned in closer, frowning. "Did he say he was sorry for killing Nicole?"
"Something like that," she said, but Wallace shook his head and glanced at his wife.
"You disagree, Mr. Pike?"
"He said he was sorry for what happened, not sorry for anything he did," Wallace grunted.
"Are you sure?" Reva fired back at her husband.
"I'm sure."
"That's not what I heard."
"Tell us about the execution, the dying," Fordyce pleaded.
Reva, still pissed at Wallace, shook her head and wiped her nose with a Kleenex.
"It was much too easy. He just went to sleep. When they opened the curtains, he was already on the little bed in there, all strapped down, looking very much at peace. He made his last statement, then he closed his eyes. We couldn't tell anything, nothing. No sign that the drugs had been administered, nothing. He just went to sleep."
"And you were thinking about Nicole and how horrible her death must have been?"
"Oh, God, yes, exactly. My poor baby. She suffered greatly, just terrible." Her voice choked and the camera zoomed even closer.
Did you want him to suffer? Fordyce asked, prompting.
She nodded vigorously, her eyes closed. Fordyce asked Wallace,
What changes now, Mr. Pike? What does this mean for your family?
Wallace thought for a second, and while he was thinking, Reva blurted, It means a lot, knowing he's dead, knowing he's been punished. I think I'll sleep better at night.
Did he claim to be innocent?
Oh, yes, Reva said, the tears gone for the moment. Same old stuff we've been hearing for years. I'm an innocent man. Well, now he's a dead man, that's all I can say.
Have you ever thought that he might be innocent, that someone else might have killed Nicole?
No, not for a minute. The monster confessed.
Fordyce pulled back a little. Have you heard of a man named Travis Boyette?
A blank face.
Who?
Travis Boyette.
At 5:30 this afternoon, he went on television in Sloan and claimed to be the killer.
Nonsense.
Here's the tape, Fordyce said, pointing to a 20-inch screen off to the right. On cue, the video of Travis Boyette appeared. The volume was high. The rest of the set was perfectly still. As he talked, Reva watched closely, frowning, almost smirking, then shaking her head no. An idiot, a fraud, she knew who the killer was. But when Boyette pulled out the class ring, shoved it at the cameras and said he had kept it for 9 years, Reva's face turned pale. Her jaw dropped, her shoulders slumped. Sean Fordyce may have been a noisy proponent of the death penalty, but like most cable screamers, he never let ideology get in the way of a sensational story. The possibility that the wrong man had just been executed would undoubtedly strike a blow against capital punishment, but Fordyce couldn't have cared less. He was smack in the middle of the hour's hottest story, number 2 on CNN's homepage, and he planned to make the most of it. And he saw nothing wrong with ambushing his own guest. He'd done it before, and he would do it again if it produced great drama. Boyette vanished from the screen.
Did you see the ring, Reva? Fordyce boomed.
Reva looked as though she'd seen a ghost. Then she collected herself and remembered that everything was being filmed.
Yes, she managed to say.
And is it Nicole's?
Oh, there's no way to tell. Who is this guy, and where did he come from?
He's a serial rapist with a rap sheet a mile long, that's who he is.
Well, there, who can believe him?
So you don't, Reva?
Of course not.
But the tears were gone, as was the spunk. Reva appeared confused, disoriented, and very tired. As Fordyce moved in for another question, she said,
Sean, it's been a long day. We're going home.
Yes, sure, Reva. Just one more question. Now that you've seen an execution, do you think they should be televised? Reva yanked the mic off her jacket and bounced to her feet.
Come on, Wallace. I'm tired.
The interview was over. Reva, Wallace, and their two children walked out of the motel with Brother Ronnie behind them. They piled into the church van and headed for Sloan. At the airport, Keith called Dana with the latest update on his little road trip. He was free-falling now, with no idea where he was going and not sure where he'd been. When he explained gently that he had just witnessed the execution, she was speechless. So was he. The conversation was brief. She asked if he was okay, and he replied that he definitely was not. The King Air lifted off at 7:05 and was soon in heavy clouds. The plane dipped and lurched, much like an old truck on a bumpy road. Moderate turbulence, the pilot had called it as they boarded. With the noise of the engines, the sense of being tossed about, and the mind-bending blur of images from the past 2 hours, Keith found it easy to close his eyes and withdraw into his own little cocoon. Robbie was withdrawn, too. He sat forward, elbows on knees, chin in hand, eyes closed, deep in thought and painful memories. Martha Handler wanted to talk, to take notes,
to capture the moment fully, but there was no one to interview. Aaron Ray stared nervously out the window as if waiting for a wing to break off. At 5,000 feet, the ride smoothed somewhat and the cabin noise died down. Robbie reclined in his seat and smiled at Martha. "What were his last words?" she asked.
"He loves his mama and he's an innocent man."
"Is that all?"
"That's enough.
There's a website for the Texas death row, an official one, and they post all of the last statements. Dante's will be up by noon tomorrow." It was beautiful. He called them by name, the bad guys. Kerber, Coffey, Judge Grail, the governor. Beautiful. Just beautiful. So he went down fighting. He was not able to fight, but he did not give an inch. The car was an old Buick owned by an old widow, Ms. Nadine Snyderwine, and it was parked beside her modest home on a concrete pad under a willow oak. She drove it 3 times a week, max, and with her failing eyesight, she knew her driving days were numbered. Ms. Snyderwine had never worked outside the home, never met a lot of people, and certainly never provoked anyone. Her car was chosen because it was accessible and, more important, because it was parked on a quiet, dark street in a very white part of town. The Buick was unlocked, not that a lock would have mattered. The driver's door was opened, a Molotov cocktail was lit and tossed inside, and the arsonists disappeared into the night without a trace. A neighbor saw flames, and the 911 call was recorded at 7:28. If there was a chance that the old Buick's wiring shorted, that the car somehow ignited on its own, such thoughts were dashed when the second 911 call came at 7:36. Another car was on fire, a Volvo wagon parked on a street halfway between the courthouse and Civitan Park. Fire trucks screamed back and forth across town, with police escorts clearing the way. The sirens were applauded by the mob at the park, a mob that was growing larger as the night grew later. But aside from underage drinking and possession of pot, no crimes were being committed. Yet. Perhaps disturbing the peace, but given the tension of the moment, the police were not inclined to enter the park and break up the fun. The crowd was in a belligerent mood, fueled by the news of Dante's death, the statements of Travis Boyette, the angry rap blasting from car stereos, and some drugs and alcohol. The police watched and pondered their options. They huddled with the National Guardsmen and plotted strategy. The wrong move could provoke a response that was unpredictable, primarily because the crowd had no real leader at that point and had no idea where the night would lead it. Every half hour or so, some clown lit a string of firecrackers, and for a split second the policemen and the guardsmen froze and strained to tell if the noise was gunfire. So far, only firecrackers. The third call was recorded at 7:40, and it was the most ominous so far. In fact, when the police chief got the details, he thought about leaving town himself. At Big Louie's Honky Tonk west of town, the gravel parking lot was packed as usual for a Thursday night, the unofficial beginning of the weekend. To kick things off, Louie offered a variety of drink specials, all involving reduced prices, and the Bubbas responded with enthusiasm. Of the vehicles parked outside the cheap metal building, virtually all were pickup trucks, and even split between Ford and Chevrolet. The arsonists picked one of each, broke the windows, tossed the cocktails, and disappeared into the darkness. A latecomer in a pickup thought he saw a couple of black boys running away, crouching low, very suspicious. But he wasn't close and didn't see their faces. In fact, he wasn't even sure they were black. When the Bubbas stampeded outside and saw flames roaring out of both trucks, they scrambled for their own. A melee ensued, a near-demolition derby as they frantically tried to get away from the fires. Many of them left, evidently no longer thirsty and anxious to get home, lock the doors, get the guns loaded. Every pickup at Big Louie's had at least one gun under the seat or in the glove box. Many had hunting rifles in the window racks. It was the wrong crowd to start a fight with. You burn a man's pickup, and he's ready for war. Chapter 28. By 8 o'clock, the drumsticks were gone, too much booze had been consumed, and most of Coffee's guests were anxious to get home and see how bad things were in town. The television crews were darting around, trying to keep up with the arsonists, and the fires effectively ended the celebration by the lake. Drew Kerber hung around, stalling, waiting for everyone to leave. He opened another beer and said to Paul Coffey,
"We need to talk."
They walked to the edge of the narrow dock, as far away from the cabin as possible, though no one else was there. Coffey also had a bottle of beer. They leaned on the railing and looked at the water below them. Kerber spat, sipped his beer, and said,
"This guy Boyette, does he worry you?"
Coffey appeared to look surprised, or at least attempted to.
"No, but he obviously worries you."
A long, slow pull on the beer, and Kerber said,
"I grew up in Denton, and there were some Boyettes in the neighborhood. Ted Boyette was a good friend, finished high school together. Then he joined the army and disappeared. I heard he got into some trouble, but I moved away, ended up here, and sort of forgot about him. You know how it is with childhood friends. You don't ever forget them, but you don't ever see them either. Anyway, in January 1999, I remember the month because we had Drum locked up. I was at the station, and some of the other guys were laughing about a thug they'd caught in a stolen pickup. They ran his record. Guy's got 3 convictions for sexual assault, a registered sex offender in 3 states, and he's only in his mid-30s. The cops were wondering, what's the record? Which pervert is registered in the most states? Someone asked his name. Someone else said T. Boyette. I didn't say a word, but I was curious as to whether it might be the kid from our neighborhood. I checked his file, saw his name was Travis, but I was still curious. A couple of days later, he was led into the courtroom for a quick appearance before the judge. I didn't want him to see me because if it had been my old pal, I didn't want to embarrass him. The courtroom was busy. It was easy not to be noticed, but it wasn't him. It was Travis Boyette, the same guy who was in town right now. I recognized him the second I saw him on television. Same slick head, same tattoo on the left side of his neck. He was here, Paul, in Sloan, in jail, at approximately the same time the girl disappeared.
Coffey thought hard for a few seconds, then said,
"Okay, assume he was here. That doesn't mean he's telling the truth about killing her." "What if he is telling the truth?"
"You can't be serious."
"Humor me, Paul. What if? What if Boyette is telling the truth? What if Boyette really has the girl's ring? What if Boyette takes them to the body? What if, Paul? Help me here. You're the lawyer."
"I'm not believing this."
"Can we face charges?"
"For what?"
"How about murder?"
"Are you drunk, Kerber?"
"I've had too much."
"Then sleep here, don't drive. Why aren't you in town with every other cop?"
"I'm a detective, not a street cop, and I'd like to keep my job, Paul. Hypothetically, what happens if this Boyette is telling the truth?"
Coffey drained his bottle, then tossed it into the lake. He lit a cigarette and blew a long trail of smoke.
"Nothing happens. We're immune. I control the grand jury, thus I control who gets prosecuted for what.
There's never been a case of a detective or a prosecutor facing charges for a bad conviction. We are the system, Kerber. We might get sued in civil court, but that's a long shot, too. Plus, we're insured by the city, so there. Stop worrying. We're Teflon."
"Would I get fired?"
"No, because that would harm you and the city in the civil suit. But they'll probably offer you early retirement. The city will take care of you."
"So we'll be okay."
"Yes, and please stop this, will you?" Kerber smiled, breathed deeply, and took another long drink.
"Just curious," he said. "That's all. I'm really not worried."
"Could have fooled me." They stared at the water for a while, both lost in their thoughts, but both thinking the same thing. Finally, Coffey said, "Boyette was in jail here, and out on parole from another state, right?"
"Right, I think it was Oklahoma, maybe Arkansas."
Then how did he get away?
I don't remember everything, but I'll check the file in the morning. Seems as though he posted bond, then disappeared. I had nothing to do with the case, and as soon as I realized it was a different boyette, I forgot about him. Until today.
Another gap in the conversation, then Coffee said,
Just relax, Kerber. You built a good case, he got a fair trial, and his guilt was affirmed by all the courts. What else can we expect? The system worked.
Hell, Drew, the boy confessed.
Of course he did. I've often wondered, though, what would have happened without the confession.
You're not worried about the confession, are you?
Oh, no. I played it by the book. Forget about it, Drew. Look, it's over. Really over. It's too late to second-guess anything we did. The boy is on the way home in a box.
The Sloan Airport was closed. The pilot activated the landing lights by radio signal from his controls, and the approach and touchdown were smooth. They taxied to the small terminal, and as soon as the props came to rest, they hurried off the plane. Robbie thanked the pilot and promised to call him later. The pilot passed along his condolences. By the time they were in the van, Aaron had spoken with Carlos and had a full report.
Fires all over town, he said. They're burning cars. Carlos says there are three television crews in the parking lot at the office. They want to talk to you, Robbie. And they want to see more of Boyette.
Why don't they burn the TV vans, Robbie asked.
Are you going to talk to them?
I don't know. Make them wait. What's Boyette doing?
Watching television. Carlos says he's pissed off because no one listened to him. And he's refusing to say anything else to the reporters.
If I attack him with a baseball bat, will you please keep me from killing him?
No, Aaron said.
As they entered the city limits, all four strained to see signs of the unrest. Aaron kept to the back streets away from downtown, and minutes later they arrived at the train station. All the lights were on. The parking lot was full, and there were indeed three TV vans waiting. By the time Robbie got out, the reporters were waiting for him. He politely asked them where they were from and what they wanted. One crew was from Sloan, one from a station in Dallas, and one from Tyler. There were several newspaper reporters, including one from Houston. Robbie offered them a deal. If he organized a small press conference outside on the platform and answered their questions, would they then leave and not come back? He reminded them that they were on his property and they could be asked to leave at any time. They accepted his deal. Everything was pleasant.
What about Travis Boyette? A reporter asked.
Robbie said, I'm not in charge of Mr. Boyette. I understand he's still inside and doesn't wish to say anything else. I'll speak with him, see what he wants to do.
Thank you, Mr. Flack.
I'll be back in 30 minutes, he said, and climbed the steps.
Keith, Aaron, and Martha followed. Emotions hit hard when they walked into the conference room and saw Carlos, Bonnie, Sammy Thomas, Christy Hines, Fanta, and Fred Pryor. There were hugs and condolences and tears.
Where's Boyette? Robbie asked.
Fred Pryor pointed to the closed door of a small office.
Good. Keep him there. Let's gather around the conference table. I'd like to describe what it was like
while it's fresh.
Reverend Schroeder might want to help because he was there. He spent time with Dante and watched him die.
Keith was already in a chair against the wall, drained, fatigued, and wiped out. They looked at him in disbelief. He nodded without a smile. Robbie took off his jacket and loosened his tie. Bonnie brought a tray of sandwiches and placed it in front of him. Aaron grabbed one, as did Martha. Keith waved them off. He'd lost his appetite. When they were settled in, Robbie began by saying, He was very brave, but he expected a last-minute miracle. I guess they all do. Like a third-grade teacher at story time, Robbie led them through the last hour of Dante's life. And when he finished, they were all crying again. Rocks began flying, some thrown by teenagers hiding behind groups of other teenagers, and some thrown by persons unseen. They landed on Walter Street, where the police and the guardsmen maintained a casual line of defense. The first injury was to a Sloan officer who took a rock in the teeth and went down hard, much to the delight of the crowd.
The sight of a cop down inspired more rock throwing, and Civitan Park was finally exploding. A police sergeant made the decision to break up the crowd and with a bullhorn ordered everyone to disperse immediately or face arrest. This provoked an angry response and the launching of more rocks and debris. The crowd jeered at the police and soldiers, spewing profanities and threats and showing no signs of obeying the order. The police and soldiers, with helmets and shields, formed a wedge, crossed the street, and entered the park. Several students, including Trey Glover, the tailback and initial leader of the protest, walked forward with their hands thrust out, volunteering for arrest. As Trey was being handcuffed, a rock bounced off the helmet of the officer arresting him. The officer yelled and cursed, then forgot about Trey and began chasing the kid who threw the rock. A few of the protesters scattered and ran through the streets, but most fought on, throwing whatever they could find. The dugouts on one side of the baseball fields were made of cinder block, perfect for breaking into pieces and hurling at the men and women in uniform. One student wrapped a string of firecrackers around a stick, lit the fuse, and tossed it into the wedge. The explosions caused the cops and soldiers to break ranks and run for cover. The mob roared. From somewhere behind the wedge, a Molotov cocktail dropped from the sky and landed on the roof of an unmarked and unoccupied police car parked at the edge of Walter Street. The flames spread quickly as the gasoline splashed over the vehicle. This created another wave of delirious cheering and yelling from the crowd. A TV van arrived as the action picked up. The reporter, a serious blonde who should have stuck to the weather, scrambled out with a microphone and was met by an angry policeman who demanded that she get back in the van and get the hell out of there. The van, painted white with bold red and yellow lettering, made an easy target, and seconds after it slid to a stop, it was being pelted with rocks and debris. Then a jagged piece of cinder block struck the reporter in the back of the head, opening a wide gash and knocking her unconscious. More cheers, more obscenities, lots of blood. Her cameraman dragged her to safety as the police called for an ambulance. To add to the fun and frenzy, smoke bombs were tossed at the police and soldiers, and at that point the decision was made to respond with tear gas. The first canisters were fired and panic swept through the crowd. It began to break up, with people running away, fanning through the neighborhood. On the streets around Civitan Park, men were on their front porches, listening to the chaos not far away, watching for any sign of movement or trouble. With the women and children safe inside, they stood guard with their shotguns and rifles, just waiting for a black face to appear. When Herman Grist of 1485 Benton Street saw three young blacks walking down the middle of the street, he fired two shotgun blasts into the air from his porch and yelled at the kids to get back to their part of town. The kids began running away. The blasts cut through the night, a grave signal that vigilantes had entered the fray. Fortunately, though, Grist did not fire again. The crowd continued to disperse, a few throwing rocks in retreat. By 9 p.m., the park had been secured, and the police and soldiers walked through the debris. Empty cans and bottles, fast food containers, cigarette butts, fireworks wrappers, enough litter for a landfill. The two dugouts were gone, nothing left but metal benches. The concession stand had been broken into, but there was nothing to take. In the wake of the tear gas, several vehicles had been abandoned, including Trey Glover's SUV. Trey and a dozen others were already at the jail. Four had volunteered, the rest had been caught. Several had been taken to the hospital because of the tear gas. Three policemen had been injured, along with the reporter. The acrid smell of the gas permeated the park. A gray cloud from the smoke bombs hung not far above the ball fields. The place resembled a battlefield without the casualties. The breakup of the party meant that 1,000 or so angry blacks were now moving around Sloan with no intention of going home and with no plans to do anything constructive. The use of tear gas infuriated them. They had been raised with the black and white videos of the dogs in Selma, the fire hoses in Birmingham, and the tear gas in Watts. That epic struggle was a part of their heritage, their DNA, a glorified chapter in their history, and suddenly here they were on the streets protesting and fighting and being gassed, just like their ancestors. They had no intention of stopping the fight. If the cops wanted to play dirty, so be it. The mayor, Harris Rooney, was monitoring the deteriorating condition of his little city from the police department, which had become the command center. He and the police chief, Joe Radford, had made the decision to scatter the crowd at Civitan Park and break things up, and they both had agreed that tear gas should be used. Reports were now flooding in by radio and cell phone that the protesters were roaming in packs, breaking windows, yelling threats at passing motorists, throwing rocks and debris, all manner of hooligan behavior. At 9:15, he called the Reverend Johnny Canty, pastor of Bethel African Methodist Church. The two had met on Tuesday when Reverend Canty had pleaded with the mayor to intervene with the governor and support a reprieve. The mayor had declined. He did not know the governor, had no clout with him whatsoever, and besides, anyone begging for a reprieve was wasting his time with Gil Newton. Canty had warned Mayor Rooney of the potential for unrest if the execution of Dante took place. The mayor had been skeptical. All skepticism had now been replaced by fear. Mrs. Canty answered the phone and explained that her husband was not home. He was at the funeral home waiting for the Drum family to return. She gave the mayor a cell phone number, and Reverend Canty finally answered.
"Well, good evening, Mayor," he said softly in his rich preacher's voice. "How are things tonight?"
"Things are pretty exciting right now, Reverend. How are you?"
"Had better days. We're here at the funeral home waiting for the family to return with the body, so I'm not doing too well right now. What can I do for you?"
"You were right about the unrest, Reverend. I didn't believe you, and I'm sorry. I should have listened, and I didn't, but things seem to be going from bad to worse. We've had 8 fires, I think, and 12 arrests, 6 injuries, and there's no reason to believe those numbers will not go up. The crowd at Civitan Park has been dispersed, but the crowd at Washington Park is growing by the minute. I wouldn't be surprised if someone doesn't get killed very soon."
"There's already been a killing, Mayor. I'm waiting on the body."
"I'm sorry."
"What's the purpose of this call, Mayor?"
"You are a well-regarded leader in your community. You are the Drum's pastor. I ask you to go to Washington Park and appeal for calm. They will listen to you. This violence and unrest serves no purpose."
"I have one question for you, Mayor. Did your police use tear gas on those kids in Civitan Park? I heard that rumor only minutes ago."
"Well, yes, it was considered necessary."
"No, it wasn't necessary, and it was a monumental mistake. By gassing our children, the police have made a bad situation worse. Don't expect me to go rushing in to repair your damage. Good night." The line was dead.
Robbie, with Aaron Ray on one side and Fred Pryor on the other, stood before the mics and cameras and answered questions. He explained that Travis Boyette was still in the building and did not wish to speak to anyone. One reporter asked if he could go inside and interview Boyette. "Only if you want to get arrested and perhaps shot," was Robbie's sharp reply. "Stay away from the building." They asked about Dante's last meal, visit, statement, and so on. Who were the witnesses? Any contact with the victim's family? Useless questions, in Robbie's opinion. But then the whole world seemed worthless at that point. After 20 minutes, he thanked them. They thanked him. He asked them to leave and not come back. In the event Boyette changed his mind and wanted to talk, Robbie would give him a phone and a number. Keith watched the press conference from a dark spot on the platform, outside the office but under its veranda. He was on the phone with Dana, recounting the events of the day, trying to stay awake, when she suddenly said that Robbie Flack was on the screen. She was watching the cable news, and there he was, live from Sloan, Texas.
"I'm about 50 feet behind him in the shadows," Keith said, voice lower.
"He looks tired," she said. "Tired and maybe a bit crazy."
"Both. The fatigue comes and goes, but I suspect he's always a little crazy."
"He looks like a wild man."
"Certified. But there's a sweet man under the surface."
"Where's Boyette?"
He's in a room, inside the building, with a television and some food. He prefers not to come out, and that's a good thing. These people knew Dante and loved him. Boyette has no friends around here. A few minutes ago, they showed the fires and talked to the mayor. He seemed a bit jumpy. Are you safe, Keith?
Sure, I can hear sirens in the distance, but nothing close.
Please be careful.
Don't worry, I'm fine.
You're not fine. You're a wreck, I can tell. Get some sleep. When are you coming home?
I plan to leave here in the morning.
What about Boyette? Is he coming back?
We have not had that conversation.
Chapter 29. Sloan had three funeral homes, two for the whites, upper and lower, and one for the blacks. Integration had been achieved in some important areas of life. Schools, politics, employment, and commercial activity. But in other areas, integration would never occur because neither race really wanted it. Sunday worship was segregated by choice. A few blacks attended the larger white churches in town, and they were welcome. Even fewer whites could be found in black churches, where they were treated like everyone else. But the vast majority stuck with their own kind, and bigotry had little to do with it. It was more a matter of tradition and preference. The whites preferred an orderly, more subdued ritual on Sunday morning. Opening prayer at 11 a.m., followed by some beautiful music, then a nice, crisp sermon, out by noon and certainly no later than 12:10, because by then they were starving. In the black churches, time was not as important. The spirit flowed more freely and made for a more spontaneous style of worship. The crack of noon was never heard. Lunch was often on the grounds whenever, with no one in a hurry to leave. And dying was so different. There was never a hurry to bury a black person, while the whites usually wanted it done within 3 days max. The black funeral home was busier, with more visitors, longer wakes, longer goodbyes. Lamb and Son had been providing dignified service in its part of town for decades. When its hearse arrived a few minutes after 10 p.m., there was a solemn crowd waiting on the lawn in front of the small chapel. The mourners were silent, with heads down, faces solemn.